Each spring, as the private sector firms descended on the brightest new minds in the workforce and offered obscene salaries and stock options, the NSA watched carefully, selected their targets, and then simply stepped in and doubled the best standing offer. What the NSA wanted, the NSA bought. Trembling with anticipation, Susan flew to Washington's Dulles International Airport, where she was met by an NSA driver who whisked her off to Fort Meade. There were 41 others who had received the same phone call that year. At 28, Susan was the youngest. She was also the only female. The visit turned out to be more of a public relations bonanza and a barrage of intelligence testing than an informational session. In the week that followed, Susan and six others were invited back. Although hesitant, Susan returned. The group was immediately separated. They underwent individual polygraph tests, background searches, handwriting analyses, and endless hours of interviews, including taped inquiries into their sexual orientations and practices. When the interviewer asked Susan if she'd ever engaged in sex with animals, she almost walked out. But somehow the mystery carried her through. The prospect of working on the cutting edge of code theory, entering the Puzzle Palace, and becoming a member of the most secretive club in the world, the National Security Agency. Becker sat riveted by her stories. They actually asked you if you'd had sex with animals? Susan shrugged. Part of the routine background check. Well, Becker fought off a grin. What did you say? She kicked him under the table. I told them no. Then she added, and until last night, it was true. In Susan's eyes, David was as close to perfect as she could imagine. He only had one unfortunate quality. Every time they went out, he insisted on picking up the check. Susan hated seeing him lay down a full day's salary on dinner for two, but Becker was immovable. Susan learned not to protest, but it still bothered her. I make more money than I know what to do with, she thought. I should be paying. Nonetheless, Susan decided that, aside from David's outdated sense of chivalry, he was ideal. He was compassionate, smart, funny, and best of all, he had a sincere interest in her work. Whether it was during trips to the Smithsonian, bike rides, or burning spaghetti in Susan's kitchen, David was perpetually curious. Susan answered what questions she could, and gave David the general, unclassified overview of the National Security Agency. What David heard enthralled him. Founded by President Truman at 12:01 a.m. on November 4, 1952, the NSA had been the most clandestine intelligence agency in the world for almost 50 years. The NSA's seven-page inception doctrine laid out a very concise agenda: to protect U.S. government communications and to intercept the communications of foreign powers. The roof of the NSA's main operations building was littered with over 500 antennas, including two large radomes that looked like enormous golf balls. The building itself was mammoth, over 2 million square feet, twice the size of CIA headquarters. Inside were 8 million feet of telephone wire and 80,000 square feet of permanently sealed windows. Susan told David about COMMAND, the agency's global reconnaissance division, a mind-boggling collection of listening posts, satellites, spies, and wiretaps around the globe. Thousands of communiques and conversations were intercepted every day, and they were all sent to the NSA's analysts for decryption. The FBI, CIA, and U.S. foreign policy advisors all depended on the NSA's intelligence to make their decisions. Becker was mesmerized. And code breaking? Where do you fit in? Susan explained how the intercepted transmissions often originated from dangerous governments, hostile factions, and terrorist groups, many of whom were inside U.S. borders. Their communications were usually encoded for secrecy in case they ended up in the wrong hands, which, thanks to comment, they usually did. Susan told David her job was to study the codes, break them by hand, and furnish the NSA with the deciphered messages. This was not entirely true. Susan felt a pang of guilt over lying to her new love, but she had no choice. A few years ago it would have been accurate, but things had changed at the NSA. The whole world of cryptography had changed. Susan's new duties were classified, even to many in the highest echelons of power. Codes, Becker said, fascinated. How do you know where to start? I mean, how do you break them? Susan smiled. You of all people should know. It's like studying a foreign language. At first, the text looks like gibberish, but as you learn the rules defining its structure, you can start to extract meaning. Becker nodded, impressed. He wanted to know more. With Bonducci's napkins and concert programs as her chalkboard, Susan set out to give her charming new pedagogue a mini-course in cryptography. She began with Julius Caesar's perfect square cipher box. Caesar, she explained, was the first code writer in history. When his foot messengers started getting ambushed and his secret communiques stolen, he devised a rudimentary way to encrypt his directives. He rearranged the text of his messages such that the correspondence looked senseless. Of course, it was not. Each message always had a letter count that was a perfect square. 16, 25, 100, depending on how much Caesar needed to say. He secretly informed his officers that when a random message arrived, they should transcribe the text into a square grid. If they did, and read top to bottom, a secret message would magically appear. Over time, Caesar's concept of rearranging text was adopted by others and modified to become more difficult to break. The pinnacle of non-computer-based encryption came during World War II. The Nazis built a baffling 12-ton encryption machine named Enigma. The device consisted of giant interlocking rotors that revolved in intricate ways and shuffled clear text into confounding arrays of seemingly senseless character groupings. Only by having another Enigma machine could the recipient break the code. Becker listened spellbound. The teacher had become the student. One night at a university performance of the Nutcracker, Susan gave David his first basic code to break. He sat through the entire intermission, pen in hand, puzzling over the 11-letter message. HL FKZC VD LDS. Finally, just as the lights dimmed for the second half, he got it. To encode, Susan had simply replaced each letter of her message with a letter preceding it in the alphabet. To decrypt the code, all Becker had to do was shift each letter one space forward in the alphabet. A became B, B became C, and so on. He quickly shifted the remaining letters. He never imagined four little syllables could make him so happy. I'm glad we met. He quickly scrawled his response and handed it to her. LD SNN. Susan read it and beamed. Becker had to laugh. Here he was, 35 years old, and his heart was doing backflips. He'd never been so attracted to a woman in his life. Her delicate European features and soft brown eyes reminded him of an ad for Estee Lauder. If Susan's body had been lanky and awkward as a teenager, it sure wasn't now. Somewhere along the way, she had developed a willowy grace. Slender and tall with full, firm breasts and a perfectly flat abdomen. David often joked that she was the first swimsuit model he'd ever met with a doctorate in applied mathematics and number theory. As the months passed, they both started to suspect they'd found something that could last a lifetime. They'd been together almost 2 years when, out of the blue, David proposed to her. It was on a weekend trip to the Smoky Mountains. They were lying on a big canopy bed at Stone Manor. He had no ring, he just blurted it out. That's what she loved about him. He was so spontaneous. She kissed him long and hard. He took her in his arms and slipped off her nightgown. "I'll take that as a yes," he said, and they made love all night by the warmth of the fire. That magical evening had been 6 months ago, before David's unexpected promotion to chairman of the Modern Language Department. Their relationship had been in a downhill slide ever since. Chapter 4. The crypto door beeped once, waking Susan from her depressing reverie. The door had rotated past its fully open position and would be closed again in 5 seconds, having made a complete 360-degree rotation. Susan gathered her thoughts and stepped through the opening. A computer made note of her entry. Although she had practically lived in crypto since its completion 3 years ago, the sight of it still amazed her. The main room was an enormous circular chamber that rose 5 stories. Its transparent dome ceiling towered 120 feet at its central peak. The plexiglass cupola was embedded with a polycarbonate mesh, a protective web capable of withstanding a 2-megaton blast. The screen filtered the sunlight into delicate lacework across the walls. Tiny particles of dust drifted upward in wide, unsuspecting spirals, captives of the dome's powerful deionizing system. The room's sloping sides arched broadly at the top, and then became almost vertical as they approached eye level. Then they became subtly translucent, and graduated to an opaque black as they reached the floor, a shimmering expanse of polished black tile that shone with an eerie luster, giving one the unsettling sensation that the floor was transparent. Black ice. Pushing through the center of the floor like the tip of a colossal torpedo was the machine for which the dome had been built. Its sleek black contour arched 23 feet in the air, before plunging back into the floor below. Curved and smooth, it was as if an enormous killer whale had been frozen mid-breach in a frigid sea. This was Translator, the single most expensive piece of computing equipment in the world, a machine the NSA swore did not exist. Like an iceberg, the machine hid 90% of its mass and power deep beneath the surface. Its secret was locked in a ceramic silo that went 6 stories straight down. A rocket-like hull surrounded by a winding maze of catwalks, cables, and hissing exhaust from the Freon cooling system. The power generators at the bottom droned in a perpetual low-frequency hum that gave the acoustics in crypto a dead, ghost-like quality. Translator, like all great technological advancements, had been a child of necessity. During the 1980s, the NSA witnessed a revolution in telecommunications that would change the world of intelligence reconnaissance forever. Public access to the Internet. More specifically, the arrival of email. Criminals, terrorists, and spies had grown tired of having their phones tapped and immediately embraced this new means of global communication. Email had the security of conventional mail and the speed of the telephone. Since the transfers traveled through underground fiber optic lines, and were never transmitted into the airwaves, they were entirely intercept-proof. At least, that was the perception. in reality, intercepting email as it zipped across the internet was child's play for the NSA's techno gurus. The internet was not the new home computer.